Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. Whether your family has been on this journey for years or you're just getting started, we're here to support and encourage you along the way. And now your hosts, Lynette Ezell and Tara Melber.
Welcome to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. I'm Tara Melber, along with Lynette Ezell. Today, we'd like to welcome Anna Palmer to talk about trust-based relational intervention parenting. That sounds like a mouthful. Anna and her husband are foster and adoptive parents, and she's the executive director of Crossroads NOLA in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Anna, thanks for being with us today. We know your schedule's tight, and we really appreciate your time.
Oh, absolutely. I'm happy to do it.
So let's just jump in, Anna. Tell us about your story, your family story, and how the Lord brought your family together, how He built your family.
Yeah, so it's definitely been an interesting journey for us. So my husband and I have actually known each other since middle school. So we started dating in high school and got married after college. And so, you know, after being married for several years, my husband was, you know, ready to start talking about, starting a family, having kids. And all of a sudden I realized, whoa, I don't know if, you know, kids are for me. Like I didn't, you know, it was something that somehow I'd gotten this far in my life and was kind of thinking, wait a second, this is a big step. I'm not sure about this. And so, you know, one of the just really cool parts of our story is that, you know, what God did as we kind of began to talk about that, consider that, is he just really turned my heart toward adoption and just kids in general. And so, as I began to learn about all the kids across the world who needed families, my heart just opened up to that. And so one day my husband actually kind of had me cornered. We were like on a road trip. I was in the car. I couldn't get out. And so he launched into this conversation again. And I know he was thinking, I've got her. She's got to talk to me about this now. And so that's when I sprung it on him that, you know, hey, God's really been speaking to me about adoption. And I think it's something we should pray about and consider. And he was shocked. He was like, I did not see this coming. And so I said, well, you know, let's not even talk about it. How about you just pray about it and I'll just keep praying about it. And if we come together on it, then we'll move forward. And if not, we'll just, you know, keep praying until we figure out what it is we're supposed to do. And so we didn't really say another word about it. And a couple of weeks later, he came to me and he's like, adoption's what God wants us to do. And so our oldest son, Eli, came to us through international adoption. He was born in Ethiopia. And so he came home to us when he was 2.5 years old. And just what an incredible time that was, just connecting with him. We were able to spend some time in Ethiopia. I was there for about 6 to 8 weeks or so. And just an incredible experience and just seeing how God places kids and families. And he's an advocate for the fatherless. And so it's just been our pleasure to be a part of that. And so a couple of years later, you know, I became, you know, increasingly aware of the need that kids right here in the U.S., you know, need families as well through our foster care system. And it's a need that unfortunately is largely hidden. And a lot of that is due to, you know, confidentialities and such related to foster care. But there's definitely a need right here in the U.S. for foster families and foster adoptive families. So God opened our heart up to that once we kind of got settled in a little bit with Eli. And my youngest son, Davis, came to us when he was 4.5 years old. And we were his foster parents for a year and kind of walked that foster care road with him and adopted him almost exactly a year later when he was 5.5 at that time. So yeah, our family has grown twice through adoption, two very, very different routes. And my boys are now, they just started third grade and second grade. And so they're about 18 months apart. Eli's the oldest, Davis is the youngest. And they're just incredible kids. And so my husband and I just feel so lucky that this is what God called us to do and to be a part of their story and for them to be a part of our story.
Well, you talk about, you know, bringing Davis in as your, was he your first foster placement?
He actually was. Yeah. He
and
was.
So were you his first foster family?
No, unfortunately we were not. So, Davis, had been in the system for quite a while when he came to our family. In fact, we were his sixth placement.
Wow.
Even as a little guy, you know, he had the very unfortunate and traumatic experience of having to be moved from home to home, family to family. So, I mean, I don't know if you can, you know, think about your being a 4-year-old, you know, 3-year-old, 4-year-old yourself and having to kind of constantly make adjustments and, you know, be moved from family to family and never really know when you're going to go or where you're going to end up. But a very, very difficult situation for any child, but especially a child that age.
So, Anna, how did you see that reveal itself in his behavior or in how he just lived his day-to-day life? Could you tell that? I mean, I feel like you obviously could, but could you tell?
And how did
he express that?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was definitely one of those things where, you know, 4-year-olds just kind of live out their reality. They don't have much of a filter or anything like that. And so, you know, we very quickly saw that when he came into our home, that these different placements and other things he'd experienced early in life, you know, left him definitely unsettled. That's probably the nicest, most, easiest way to put it. But he just lacked the ability to really just regulate his emotions and, you know, his behavior. And so he's definitely a kid who his downstairs brain, if you're familiar with any of the brain research that we see in literature today, talks about, you know, our fight, flight, or freeze. And that if a child spends too much time being anxious or worried or in that fight, flight, or freeze state, then that part of their brain becomes essentially trigger happy. And so, you know, what is perceived as, you know, a threat, something they perceive as a threat, is not always a threat. So a loud knock at the door can trigger their downstairs brain, that flight, fight, or freeze. And everyone else in the house is fine. And we're, you know, everybody's kind of looking around going, what's up with this kid? Why is he all of a sudden freaking out or dysregulated or whatever it is?
Right.
So when you understand and start thinking about how trauma affects a child's brain, you really can begin to reframe their behaviors. You know, and so for Davis, it was, you know, he'd been moved around a lot. And so he just really had just this lack of control. Like he never knew what was going to happen to him. And so, you know, asking him to do, you know, certain things, even just like the bedtime routine. I remember when he first came home, you know, one of the things we did is that every night we sat down and we made a list and we drew out little pictures and we said, okay, you know, it's time to get ready for bed. So first we're going to take a bath and then we're going to brush our teeth and then we're going to read a Bible story and then we're going to say prayers and then it's going to be time for bed. And so we would literally draw that out and we would check it off after each step. And so that was just a way of letting him know, like, hey, this is a time of the night when you typically have trouble. You know, this is a trouble spot for you. We don't know why that is, but you have high anxiety around this time. So we're going to tell you exactly what's about to happen. And when we tuck you in, we're going to be close by. So I can't even remember for how long, but for quite some time, either my husband or I, lay down. We had two twin beds in his room, but we would lay down on the bed in that the other bed in the same room until he fell asleep, just so he knew we were close, he was safe, we weren't going anywhere. And so it was a lot of little things like that we did to help him really just give him a level of felt safety. So we knew he was safe, we knew that he was going to have food, that he was going to be protected, that he was going to be loved, but we had to do whatever it took to make sure he felt that. And so that looked a little different than maybe we would have done if we were raising a child that we had from birth that never had any traumatic experiences. But we knew that we had to take his early childhood before us into account as we made parenting decisions.
You know, that's so interesting. When we brought our daughter home, one of our adopted children, people would come and go from our house. My husband was a pastor, and so they wanted to bring gifts or food or whatever. That did not help us at the time because people were coming and going, knocking on the door, being around all these white people with blonde hair, not our family, but, you know, just friends, was just setting us back, you know, for days. But we finally, you know, we realized that we had to address her physical issues pretty quickly. Did you find that with Davis, that he had some physical issues that you needed to address with him?
Yeah, we did. So a good, the first couple months we spent kind of figuring out what those things were. So one of the things we realized is that he wasn't sleeping really well, which for anyone who has ever had a period of time where you didn't sleep really well, you know that sleep is actually very, very important for everyone in the house.
Yes, it is.
So, so we scheduled an appointment with the ENT. And I mean, as soon as she took a look, her reaction was like, whoa, yeah, he's definitely not sleeping because his tonsils and adenoids are huge. So we had to schedule that surgery to take care of that issue. Another thing that we noticed early on is that, man, one of the things we noticed about him right away is, man, he was trying so hard. Like, he wanted to do the right thing, and he wanted to make good choices, not be impulsive. But around 4 o'clock every afternoon, we just noticed his capacity to kind of to handle various situations and to not be impulsive really just diminished. And so we were just kind of scratching our head because we knew, like, okay, it's not super late, so – you know, and we just, he just had an after school snack. So he should be kind of, you know, not having this hard of a time right now. So what's the deal? So my husband actually, probably for the first several months Davis was with us, he kept Dr. Purvis and Dr. Cross's book, The Connected Child, like literally in his back pocket. And so he was constantly reading there. He was constantly reading that and just trying to kind of, you know, get insight into what was going on. And so one day he realized, he was like, you know, this book mentions that a lot of kids from hard places sometimes will have an iron deficiency. And maybe that's what's going on with Davis, you know, this just a lack of energy at the end of the day. And so we took him to the pediatrician, had it tested. And sure enough, Davis had an iron deficiency. And as soon as we got him on a supplement to help with that, we noticed an immediate change.
Oh, that's wonderful.
In his capacity. Yeah. And so it was just like night and day. Honestly, we, you know, we were kicking ourselves that we didn't figure it out sooner because it made just such a huge difference. And here we had our little guy that was struggling every day, and we're just racking our brains to figure out what it is. And it ended up being, you know, a fairly simple solution.
So when you're parenting children that have had traumatic beginnings, it's almost like you just can go through and say, what are some of the simplest things we can look at to give them the best ability to be able to cope?
That's right.
So starting with those physical needs is so important. But as you kind of went through parenting and you figured out the sleep issue and that his tonsils were big and that he needed iron, then he still, I'm sure, probably had moments where he was having meltdowns and you're thinking, oh my word, I don't know what to do now. So can you explain maybe some of the things that you did that were beneficial in parenting Davis in this way?
Yeah, so one of the things that we really honestly, so Jen and I both grew up, you know, in South Georgia, and so very traditional parenting methods, but also both came from, you know, very safe and loving homes at the same time. So for us, we really had to realize that the parenting methods that were used with us had a lot to do, their effectiveness had a lot to do with where we came from.
Sure.
We came from safe places. And so with Davis, we knew that's not where he came from. And so our parenting methods needed to look different. And so that's kind of the first step is acknowledging that and being willing to say, okay, we're going to have to make some adjustments here. And one of the adjustments that we did early on is we did redos. And so to be honest with you, the first time I was told about, you know, a redo, I was like, you know, that's never going to work. Because the concept is basically when a child, you know, makes a mistake, let's say they're disrespectful or maybe they throw a toy across the room or something like that, instead of launching into a, you shouldn't, you know, here's why you shouldn't do that, and I can't believe you did that, and, you know, go to timeout until you can do it better, you know. What a redo says is you just say, like, whoa, hey, that's not how we treat our toys. I want you to go pick that toy up and go place it in the basket like you know you're supposed to, and give the child an opportunity without being punitive to just very simply and quickly correct the behavior. Or if they're mouthy, you know, to say, whoa, try that again, you know, try asking with respect, or, you know, whatever it is, that whatever the behavior is you want them to redo. And I thought, okay, yeah, this is going to work. I cannot tell you how shocked I was, you know, the first couple of times. You know, the first time you're like, oh, that's, you know, okay, so it worked once. Well, you know, it's not going to keep working. But just given a kid an opportunity to go, oh, yeah, that wasn't the right. Let me just, mm-hmm. you know, instead of making a big deal of it, just so we did a lot of redos in our home. And we actually apply this to our marriage. You know, sometimes, you know, I'll say something to Don and I'll be like, can I have a redo on that one? Let me say that a different way. And so we're big on redos at the Palmer House. But the other thing that we had to kind of make an adjustment on is giving choices. So for John and I, like when our parents instructed us to do something, it was like, you know, do it. That was your only that was your only choice. And so one of the things that we know is that when kids are from hard places, giving them that element of control where they feel like they have a part in the decision making process and things aren't just happening to them, but they are collaborators. And what's kind of going on around them is really empowering and allows them to really develop a lot of self-control and regulation. And so, you know, we really started giving Davis a lot of choices. So in our house, it would be like, okay, Davis, it's time to get ready for bed. Would you like to brush your teeth first, or would you like to put on your pajamas first? It's time to go to school. Would you like to put your shoes on first, or, you know, eat your breakfast first? And so it's always with choices, it's always two choices that the parent or the adult, the caregiver is okay with. So we wouldn't say, you know, okay, Davis, do you want to brush your teeth or eat a lollipop? Because we wouldn't be okay with him eating a lollipop right. at that point. So that's not a good choice. But we also wouldn't say something like, do you want to brush your teeth now, or do you want to brush your teeth now? You
yeah. know, like that's not a choice.
That's not really right. a choice either. And so we got really, especially early on, Davis needed a lot of choices. And so we got really, really creative with how we gave choices. And the interesting thing, is that, man, it just, these techniques just really allow children to develop capacity. And so in our house today, we don't have to be, I mean, giving choices is still kind of a part of what we do to a certain extent, but we don't have to give nearly as many choices mm-hmm. As we used to. And so, yeah, it's just been incredible to see him kind of move along the road of building capacity, being able to, you know, not have a meltdown when things get hard. Just the other day, he was walking down to a neighbor's to play on a water slide, and he couldn't find his flip-flops. And so his brother, you know, found his and was headed out the door, and he's looking for his flip-flops. And I could tell he was getting frustrated, but he found them. But then he got up and was, you know, about to walk out, and he realized he'd set his towel down. And so he came back in looking for his towel, and he was just, I could tell he's getting frustrated. I said, Davis, take a deep breath. Because when you get frustrated, it's hard for you, you know, it gets really, really hard for you to think clearly. And he looked at me and he said, Mom, it's not really, really hard for me to think right now. It's just a little bit hard for me to think. he even now realized, like, he's like, I'm not totally, like, pushed over the edge
right.
like this yet, but he knows what that feels like. He knows what that feels like to become frustrated or anxious, and that his brain feels, you know, out of control, or like right. it's not working right. And he has some skills, taking deep breaths and other things that he can do to calm himself down so that his brain can work right, so to speak.
Well, I think that's so important, because when you're teaching and training that hardcore at the very beginning, and you're talking to them about regulating their emotions and all of that, it gives them the ability to know what's going on in their mind. So they can't verbalize that, but you're helping them put words to how they're feeling. So I just think that's pretty incredible. I have just really one final question for you is, how did you even know to start parenting like this?
You know, when we went through with our international adoption, the mm-hmm. agency we used required us to read The Connected Child, the book I mentioned earlier by mm-hmm. Dr. Karen Purvis and Dr. David Cross. And we just, you know, from that, we just saw very quickly that this was something we were going to need to do.
Absolutely.
So that book was an introduction. Yeah, that book was an introduction for us. And then, you know, when Davis came along, we knew based on, you know, and we're also kind of, at least for me, I'm a reader and a learner. And so this stuff is really interesting to me. So I'd done a little more studying up on it and had pretty much bought into the concept that early childhood trauma affects the brain and therefore affects behavior. And so it needs to be addressed. Like, love is great, but one of the things that we knew too is like we were gonna love him unconditionally, but we also needed to be competent in our parenting skills, and for us we needed to develop some new ones, and so we were pretty committed to that from the beginning.
Well, Anna, this is good stuff. Tara, we can't just stop here.
No, we can't.
So, Anna, can you come back and spend some more time with us, and let's kind of do a part two, because we really want to get into the trust-based relational intervention parenting, because it's just you've kind of done a bridge there to get into this topic, and I think it would be so encouraging to so many of our parents. So can you hang on and we can continue talking?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to.
All right. Well, you know, James 1:5 says that if any of us lacks wisdom, that we should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. And Lord knows that we need wisdom when we're parenting children.
Absolutely.
And, you know, Paul also tells us to not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we'll reap a harvest if we don't give up. So as we're parenting these children, we have to remember to ask for wisdom, and that even though we feel weary, that we don't have to give up. The Lord will give us what we need to do what he's called us to do. So thanks so much, Anna.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Adopting and Fostering Home podcast. We're so glad you've taken time to listen today. Keep in mind, we are a ministry of the North American Mission Board and funded through the Annie Armstrong offering and your giving to the cooperative program. We look forward to talking more about adoption, fostering, and orphan care, and how you can be involved.